From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The big oil companies are on the decline because petrostates like Kazakhstan and Russia are demanding more control over their oil fields and marginalizing big oil. That's the analysis of Steve Levine, who covered Central Asia for the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. He's written a new book called The Oil and the Glory. We'll talk about oil and how it explains some of Vladimir Putin's positions, including his response to Iran's nuclear program. Also, we talk with trumpeter and composer Terrence Blanchard about composing scores for Spike Lee films, including Lee's documentary on Hurricane Katrina. Blanchard and his mother were featured in that film, returning to her home for the first time facing the damage. Blanchard's new CD is a requiem for Katrina. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Despite its unprecedented profits, big oil is on the decline. Meanwhile, petrostates like Kazakhstan and Russia are demanding and obtaining more control over their own oil fields and increasingly marginalizing the once omnipotent oil majors. This is what my guest journalist Steve Levine writes in his blog. He also has a lot to say about how oil figures into Vladimir Putin's politics and how Putin is trying to position himself on the Iranian nuclear issue. In Levine's new book, The Oil and the Glory, he reports on the struggle for control of oil in the Caspian region and how that has changed the energy industry and geopolitics. The countries that border the Caspian Sea are Russia, Iran, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, and Azerbaijan. Steve Levine covered Central Asia and the Caucasus for 11 years. He ran the Wall Street Journal Bureau for the region and before that covered it for the New York Times. After September 11th, he did some work with Daniel Pearl and later helped investigate Pearl's kidnapping and beheading. Levine was portrayed in the film A Mighty Heart. Steve Levine, welcome to Fresh Air. How much oil is at stake in the Caspian Sea?
There's a minimum of 30 billion barrels of recoverable oil in the entire Caspian, and probably much more. And a way of understanding that is that when the biggest fields come online finally in the next 5 or 10 years, there will be approximately 5 million barrels of oil per day coming onto the world market from there. And that's the difference between surplus and shortage on the world market, which is where prices go up or down. And so it's really a very important volume.
So tell us more about how the future of oil can be changed by the Caspian Sea.
There are a couple of things. One is that the Caspian, again, is this player on the margin. It's a region that's not connected to the Persian Gulf, and so it's not vulnerable to the politics, to the wars, to that whole cauldron of events going on all over the Middle East. And so it's an independent source of oil. It is a strongly pro-Western area. And so it will play along with the politics that the West tends to play. And in addition, in a sense that I think everyone can understand, it's the last hurrah, really, of big oil. This is a region that has straddled the era when big oil made policy, brought governments to power all over the world. And now, when big oil is really weak and is in a decline, really, it's deceptive. It looks like it's very powerful. The profits are so big, but it really is. It's in a slow decline right now.
You know, you say that the countries on the Caspian Sea are pro-Western, but one of the countries is Iran, and another is Russia. Iran is definitely not pro-Western, and Russia, it's sometimes hard to tell like where they are. So it's more ambiguous than that, don't you think?
Well, sure. But when we speak of Caspian oil, really, it's true Russia and Iran are on that sea. But the oil that we're talking about is from the other three states surrounding that sea, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, and Azerbaijan. And it's their oil and their natural gas that will make this difference. And the U.S., for a number of years, has put itself as a strategic policy behind them to make sure that their energy gets to the West.
Now, in looking at oil and the Caspian Sea, let's look for a moment at Russia and Iran. Does their relationship become clearer if you look at oil?
Sure. It seems pretty clear to me what they're all about. They are both trying to be voices and powers on the world stage. They both see themselves as historically and culturally important players in the world, and they want to be seen that way now, and they resent the United States having this superpower, unipower position in the world, and they have linked together on a number of issues, the main one being oil, another one being nuclear power, in order to assert their voice in the world.
I want to quote you something that Garry Kasparov said on Bill Maher's show, Politically Incorrect, last week. And, you know, for our listeners who haven't been following Kasparov, who up until this point was most famous as a chess master, is now very famous as a dissident in Russia, and he is running for president and is being very outspoken against Putin. So he said on Friday night, Bush tried to play psychiatrist and look at Putin's eyes, searching his soul instead of looking at his record. And now Putin is spitting in Bush's face by making his open friendship with Ahmadinejad. But Putin has only one item in his political agenda. He needs high oil prices. And tension in the Middle East helps him to keep oil prices high. So that's why he sells nuclear technology to Iran. He sells missiles to Hezbollah and Hamas via Syria, because it helps Putin stay in power. If the oil price goes down, Putin goes down. What do you make of that analysis? Do you think that that's an accurate analysis?
Well, I think it's self-serving to a certain degree for Kasparov, certainly. But there's a kernel of truth there, the kernel being that what Russia is today, what Putin is today, is a reflection of high oil prices. Russia is a new power on the world stage because it has so much money. His analysis that somehow Putin is conspiring to keep them high, to keep there being tension in the Middle East and between the West and Iran, I think that goes a little bit over the top. But the essence of what he says, that Putin is spitting in the face of the West and the basis of his power, this is true. And the other thing is that it's really a long point that one has to understand. When you look at the last 15 years, when you look at what Russia and the United States have been through on the Caspian Sea, the conflict, the struggle for geopolitical power in that region, this is all about Russia doing exactly that. And Putin is the manifestation of the current change in geopolitics.
So oil profits have really changed the Russian economy and the life of middle-class Russians.
There are two components here. One is, what have high oil prices done for the average Russian? And it's true that Russians are living better than they ever have. They have more money, they have more disposable income, and this is one of the main reasons why Putin is so popular at home and why he can carry out the kind of politics, domestic and overseas politics, that he does. But the other component is, it is extremely popular at home to go around, as Kasparov said, spitting in the face of the West. They love this. The whole idea of making the United States uncomfortable around the world, this plays very well at home. And look, the Russians and that whole former Soviet region, they're not friends with Iran. They're as nervous as the West is about Iran. Really, this is what you hear when you're there, but it is convenient for Putin, with his geopolitical aspirations, to ally with Iran on these questions.
Why is it convenient for him? What does he get from it?
Iran is the American hot button. Nothing sends Dick Cheney or George Bush into a frenzy than Iran. The whole question of Iran and the nuclear weapons, and they cannot stand that Ahmadinejad goes around sticking his chest out and poking his eye in the West. And by Putin allying with Ahmadinejad and Ahmadinejad allying with Putin, it makes both of them stronger. And specifically on the oil question, they are, to a certain degree, halting or slowing development of oil in these other Caspian nations by allying, by telling these other republics, for example, you cannot install a pipeline crossing the Caspian Sea, delivering Kazakhstan's enormous oil reserves and Turkmenistan's enormous natural gas reserves to Europe, which would help to change the geopolitical balance in Europe and help the United States there. And because they ally, they have managed, at least for now, to halt the construction of this very important pipeline.
So as the story with Iran continues to play out, what are you looking for when you look at the relationship between Russia and Iran?
I'm curious at Putin's approach to Iran and the other republics, a meeting that happened a week ago between them where Putin made a big show about demonstrating that he was Iran's friend, very public friend. We will not serve as a staging ground to attack you. I just wonder if Putin craves international recognition. He wants to appear like the bad boy abroad because it plays so well at home. But at the same time, Russia historically and Russia now has always craved the respect and felt that it never got it. Imagine if Putin were able to broker a deal that satisfied the United States and Europe and satisfied Iran on the nuclear question, how he would look. He would look like a hero, and he would finally win the deference to a certain degree, diplomatic deference, abroad. He would be a real player rather than a gadfly. And I've had this sneaking suspicion that this is what he's after.
My guest is journalist Steve Levine. His new book is called The Oil and the Glory, The Pursuit of Empire and Fortune on the Caspian Sea. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Steve Levine. He's the author of the new book, The Oil and the Glory, The Pursuit of Empire and Fortune on the Caspian Sea. He reported from that region for 11 years. For the last three, he ran the Wall Street Journal's bureau there. He also reported from there for the New York Times. There have been meetings going on between a consortium of the big oil companies, the big Western oil companies, and Kazakhstan over this giant oil field in Kazakhstan called the Kashagan oil field. What's the importance of this oil field and what are the negotiations about?
Well, the importance of the field, the Kashagan field, is that it's the largest oil discovery anywhere on the planet in the last 30 or 40 years. It is a field, enormous field, with at least 13 billion barrels of, just to make that clear, a giant oil field, this term giant, is 1 billion barrels. So here you have 13 times that in this one field, and that's the main significance. And the big oil companies love this field. This is a chance for them, first of all, to have a lot of oil, but also oil men are not just in this game for the money, or else they could go into banking. The engineers and the geologists, these are romantics, and they see a lot of romance about this field. And the current negotiations are a national conflict. The oil companies are at least 5 years behind their contractual commitment for delivering the first oil from the field. They're more than twice over budget on the spending. And this really irritates the Kazakhs because it means that all of these plans that they've made for building the country, for spending and for lining pockets, is delayed for at least 5 years. But it's also, in a larger sense, it's an assertion. It's a phenomenon that we're seeing today. These countries like Venezuela and Russia and now Kazakhstan that are far more assertive on the world stage and at home regarding ownership of their natural resources. This is the latest example of that. And these oil companies are having to mollify the Kazakhs. And it's also a sign of the times. We are seeing the last years, really the last decade or two, of these big oil companies as we know them today. And this negotiation really, it illustrates that changing of the guard, where the big petropowers in the world are going to be states, Kazakhstan, Russia, Venezuela, the Saudis, and not Exxon and Chevron and BP and Shell.
So the oil companies aren't writing the rules. The countries are more and more trying to write the rules and telling the oil companies what they can do and what they can't and what they're expected to achieve?
Yes. Yes, that's exactly right. And really, the best window into this phenomena, this dynamic that's going on right now, is this negotiation over the Kazakhstan field. It's really what's happening is that the oil companies are being turned into employees. They are, in our lifetimes, not going to be swaggering, testosterone-driven companies. They are going to be mousy employees of state oil companies like the Kazakhstan oil company.
Several of the Caspian states and the United States would like to see a pipeline built for Caspian oil that would bypass Russia. Why do Caspian states and the United States want to see that happen?
The short answer is that Russia has spent the whole post-Soviet period strangling the economies of Central Asia, of the Caucasus, of these Caspian states. And the way that it's done it is through its control of most of the natural gas and oil pipelines leaving the region, going to the west. Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, and Azerbaijan cannot export a single barrel of oil or a cubic meter of natural gas without crossing into Russia. Azerbaijan is in a better place. It has an independent pipeline, but Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan are really stuck. And so the idea is to build an independent natural gas pipeline and possibly a companion oil pipeline leading from Turkmenistan across the sea, the Caspian Sea, going west to Azerbaijan and then on to Europe, the idea being that this provides financial, economic independence to these states and therefore political independence.
There's a picture in your book of Kazakhstan's new capital that was built with oil money, and it's incredible looking. I mean, why don't you describe a little bit about what Kazakhstan has done with some of its oil wealth in giving the country, or at least parts of it, a new look?
The president of Kazakhstan, Nursultan Nazarbayev, decided, like a lot of new presidents do in small countries around the world, I'm going to move the capital. He has a Peter the Great complex and wanted to build a new capital on the steppe, and he did. Astana is the name, and it looks like Disneyland. It was a malarial, swampy, windswept, flat, just horrendous place. This was the capital of Khrushchev's Virgin Lands program. It's a place where you wouldn't want to go, and he decided this was going to be the place. And at first, it was kind of a joke. Back in the 90s, it was a Potemkin village. They plastered vinyl on the fronts and the sides of the buildings fronting the main boulevard running through town. So it would look new, but then you go around the back of the building, on the other side of the building, and it's the old, decrepit look. And you walk two blocks from the center, and people have no heat, no electricity, and there are cows and goats everywhere, and huge mosquitoes. But over time, it is amazing. It is a very impressive place, depending, you know, what your taste is in architecture. And if you wanted to do a deal, an oil deal, during the late 1990s and the, you know, after 2000, Nazarbayev made you put money, tens of millions of dollars, into the fund to make the Capitol.
So are those vinyl facades there now, or was that before the Capitol was remade?
No, that's when the Capitol was declared, when it was Astana was declared the new capital. This was the first thing that was done, the vinyl. Now, I say that's changed. They've got the vinyl all the way around the buildings now. but for a long time, yeah, that's how it looked.
Mm-hmm. Steve Levine, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Steve Levine's new book is called The Oil and the Glory, The Pursuit of Empire and Fortune on the Caspian Sea. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of their classics edition of The Essential Tales and Poems of Edgar Allan Poe, in stores and online at bn.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. And from Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting Wes Anderson's The Darjeeling Limited, about three brothers, 11 suitcases, and a laminating machine, now in select theaters. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with Terrence Blanchard about composing music for Spike Lee films, including Lee's documentary about Hurricane Katrina. Blanchard is featured in the film, taking his mother home for the first time after the hurricane, when she is devastated by the damage. Blanchard's new CD is a requiem for Katrina. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Terrence Blanchard, is a trumpeter and composer who got his start in Art Blakey's band and started writing film music working with Spike Lee. Blanchard composed the scores for several Spike Lee films, including Inside Man, 25th Hour, Malcolm X, and When the Levees Broke, Lee's documentary about Hurricane Katrina. Blanchard's new CD is called A Tale of God's Will, A Requiem for Katrina. He'll perform music from that CD with the New Orleans Philharmonic, November 3rd. Here's a track from the CD called Dear Mom. When I recorded my interview with Terrence Blanchard earlier this month, we didn't know we'd be running it at a time when thousands of Californians are dealing with catastrophic fires that, like Katrina, have left many people homeless. Our thoughts are with them. Terrence Blanchard and his mother were featured in Spike Lee's documentary about Katrina. They were shown returning to her home in New Orleans for the first time after the hurricane. It's the house Terrence Blanchard grew up in. I want to play that scene, but since we'll only be hearing it, not seeing it, I'll let Blanchard describe what's happening.
Well, when we first got there, I had some other concerns that I never told anybody about, because my mom had told me a story about a cousin of ours who had gone to a home, and it was pretty dark when she went in, and she thought the floor was moving, and when she looked down, there were snakes in the home. So I was a little nervous about that. I didn't know what to expect. I was also nervous and fearful of the air inside the home, so I was trying to put a mask on. You don't see that in the documentary. My mom got frustrated, so she didn't want the mask on, so I was totally fearful of her contracting something, you know, in her respiratory system, you know, by breathing.
She's wearing a mask in part of the scene.
She didn't have on the mask that I tried to put on. I mean, you know, there was a heavy-duty professional mask.
I see.
That I tried to give my mother, and she's like, no. So we put the little mask on, and I was still nervous about all of that. But the other thing that I was worried about was my mom stepping through all of the debris, you know, because my mom is not a tall woman at all, and, you know, there was a lot of debris to step over. I can't remember if you can see it in the documentary, but the furniture was everywhere in the house. And my mom was so emotional that she was just walking through the house without waiting for me to assist her through, you know, through stepping through all of the rubble. So that was another concern. And the other thing was, look, I mean, my mom was crushed, you know, and the thing that I kept thinking about, if you watch the documentary, that I just have this nervous chant of we can rebuild this, because, you know, I didn't want to see my mom hurt like that. Nobody wants to experience that, you know, and I tried to ease her hurt as best I could in that moment, which, you know, wasn't much help at that particular moment, because she had to experience that.
Let's hear the scene from Spike Lee's documentary When the Levees Broke, and my guess is Terrence Blanchard, he scored that movie, and his new CD, A Tale of God's Will, features music from the film as well as new music. So this is the scene in which he escorts his mother back to her home after the hurricane, and it's the first time she's seen it since the hurricane.
Oh, mercy. Wait. Look, this thing's way over here.
What is that?
That's the thing you gave me, it was over here. What is that over there?
What is what?
That.
That's a, that should look like your china closet.
The china closet don't have any business being over here. It's in the den.
I know.
Oh, Lord, the pictures I had in there. As soon as this picture's still up on the wall.
There's nothing on the wall.
Oh, Lord, have mercy.
You can rebuild this stuff, though.
Yeah, that's easier said than done.
That's more.
Oh, Lord have mercy. Oh, I knew it was devastation, but I didn't think it was this bad. It's unbelievable.
I didn't know how bad it was. Today, you know, when we went into the house, that was really hard because, you know, it's like I can't go home. You know what I mean? I'm sorry.
That's Terrence Blanchard and his mother in a scene from the Spike Lee documentary, When the Levees Broke. Terrence, did you grow up in that house?
Yeah. The thing that you need to know about that house is while we were walking through it, the front part of the house, the thing I kept thinking of was that's the area where my father used to make me practice day in and day out on my piano studies, walking through the hall. All of those doors we passed by were the doors that used to slam shut when my father would play his operatic music in the front when everybody was trying to find a bit of peace and quiet. There were a lot of memories that I was experiencing walking through the house at that particular moment. It was very bizarre to see it in that condition. To think that that could happen in my neighborhood was just something we could never fathom. And I was profoundly frustrated and angry, you know, at the thought that when I stepped outside, the train tracks in the neighborhood, which was used for commercial use, was above sea level, you know, and the water never rose above those train tracks. So at the same time that the city was under, that particular neighborhood was underwater, commerce could still function, people could still make money, you know, and to think that somebody knew that there was a possibility that this could happen. I don't know. It was a hard thing to experience, you know.
Well, why don't we hear another track from your latest CD, which is called A Tale of God's Will, A Requiem for Katrina. And this is one of the compositions that was written for the CD, as opposed to some of the compositions on this CD that were actually written for the Spike Lee documentary, When the Levees Broke. So we're going to hear Ghost of Congo Square. Tell us the story behind this piece.
Well, you know, when we were in the studio recording the music for the CD, you know, I kept hearing this phrase in my head, this is a tale of God's will. The guys were in the studio actually just jamming, and it was just bass and saxophone. And we started getting sounds on instruments, and the bass and the saxophonists started to play, and they just did a duo thing, and I said, wow. The idea of the ghost came to me, and then I started thinking about Congo Square, and I started thinking about how, you know, slaves and free men of color and all different types of people would congregate in Congo Square, and that's an area of New Orleans where it is said that jazz originated. And I thought about all of those spirits and all of those souls who have probably tried to give us warning, fair warning about what could possibly happen in New Orleans, because we've been bypassed so many times by major hurricanes. And we weren't listening. So I decided to come up with these ghosts. And the first ghost that we hear on the CD is Ghost of Congo Square.
Well, here it is from Terrence Blanchard's CD, A Tale of God's Will. That's music from Terrence Blanchard's new CD, A Tale of God's Will, A Requiem for Katrina. We'll talk more with Blanchard after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is trumpeter and composer Terrence Blanchard, and he'll be performing on November 3rd with the New Orleans Philharmonic, music that he composed for Spike Lee's documentary about Katrina, When the Levees Broke, and music from his CD, A Tale of God's Will, A Requiem for Katrina. And then on December 8th, he'll be at the Kennedy Center playing some of that music, as well as doing a retrospective of other scores that he wrote for Spike Lee movies. I'd like to talk with you about writing movie music. And to start off, I'd like to play the theme that you wrote for a movie Spike Lee directed called 25th Hour. I just particularly love this piece of music. And the movie stars Edward Norton as a drug dealer who's been convicted and has 24 hours before he starts serving his 7-year sentence. Would you talk a little bit about composing this theme and the mood that you wanted to get?
Well, the interesting thing, I have to back up a bit. The interesting thing about working with Spike is that, you know, we have this very interesting way of working. You know, Spike will ask me to submit, you know, a number of themes. And I'll send him a CD of, let's say if I send him a CD of maybe 7 or 8 themes, he starts to assign those themes to characters. The interesting thing with Spike is that when I started to think about this movie, like I've done in the past with all of his movies, I will come up with certain ideas, hoping that he will pick this one as the main theme or this one for this character, and he never does. He always mixes them up, which is great because then it poses a different challenge for me. So if you watch Brian Cox's character, that theme is a theme that I actually had written as the main theme for 25th Hour. This theme was something that I had written for someone else, and I can't remember now. And this is the brilliance of Spike, because he can hear things outside of the area of what a musician would hear. He hears it as a voyeur, and he has a more universal approach to it. So it stretches you a bit.
Let's hear just like an excerpt of the theme that you wrote for 25th Hour. That's an excerpt of the theme composed by Terrence Blanchard for Spike Lee's film 25th Hour. Well, what I want to do, now that we've heard the actual theme, and mm-hmm. this theme is kind of replayed in variations, you know, throughout the movie, I want our listeners to hear it with dialogue behind it. It's really more of a monologue. What's happening in this scene is that, you know, Edward Norton is the drug dealer who has 24 hours before going to prison for 7 years. And in this scene, his father, played by Brian Cox, is driving him to prison. Those 24 hours have ended. And I want to play an excerpt of that scene with Brian Cox and your music behind him.
We'll drive. Keep driving. Head out to the middle of nowhere. Take that road as far as it takes us. You've never been west of Philly, have you? This is a beautiful country, Monty. It's beautiful out there. Looks like a different world. Mountains, hills, cows, farms, and white churches. I drove out west with your mother one time, before you was born. Brooklyn to the Pacific in 3 days. Just enough money for gas, sandwiches, and coffee. But we made it. Every man, woman, and child alive should see the desert one time before they die. Nothing at all for miles around. Nothing but sand and rocks and cactus and blue sky. Not a soul in sight. No sirens. No car alarms. Nobody honking at you. No madmen cursing or pissing on the streets. You find the silence out there. You find the peace. You can find God.
That's Brian Cox in a scene from the 25th Hour, the music composed by my guest, Terrence Blanchard. I just think that's a really perfect film moment and such beautiful interaction between the voice and the music. When did you first see the scene?
Well, the first version of the scene, there were a few versions that I'd seen. It was very early on in the editing process. That's the thing that's kind of cool about working with Spike. Once Spike starts to edit, even before he starts to edit, he will fly me up or send me footage and make sure I get a chance to see something. And the thing that he told me about this film, which was very important, was he kept telling me there's not going to be a lot of, source music. You know, it was going to be mostly score. And he said it's going to culminate with this long scene at the end that's going to, bring it all together. So he wanted me to keep all of that in mind when writing the music. But the main thing about that particular scene is that I remember now, my thought was, it has to be a heart-wrenching thing for a father to watch his son go to jail. And the natural inclination, just like in the documentary with my mother, was to ease her pain. And he's trying to ease his son's pain. And he's trying to find some solution to this problem. So I tried to, even though it's the main theme of the film, I tried to write the music based around the father's emotional state.
Are there places that writing film music have led you that you otherwise never would have gone musically?
Oh, yes, indeed. I mean, the thing about working in film is that it's allowed me to work in areas that I never would have been able to experience just by being a jazz musician. Writing for orchestra, writing for different other types of musical situations. I just did a film called Talk to Me with Don Cheadle, and mm-hmm. that's music. It's all based around 70s R&B, so we got a chance to do that as well. And all of that stuff is broadened my musical experience and awareness. And it's been a great road to follow, in this artistic endeavor of mine.
At what point in your life did you actually start hearing the music in movies? attention to it?
Well, the first time I really heard the score to a film was a film called Chinatown. And because I remember the trumpet melody was just a very beautiful thing. The next film was, oddly enough, Star Wars, because of all of the brass fanfare. But I still wasn't really, I hadn't been bitten by the bug yet. It wasn't until I actually started working with Spike and his father was writing music that I even thought about becoming a film composer. Because prior to that, even though I loved the music, I just didn't see a way for me to enter into that business. So it wasn't something that I was thinking about. But when I worked with Spike just as a session player and his father was writing the music, I was like, wow, this is an interesting process to witness. I said, I'd like to get a chance at this. And lo and behold, I did.
Yes, Spike's father, the bass player and composer, Billy. So you were in the band playing the mm-hmm. score. How did you go from that to actually writing for Spike Lee?
Well, we were doing the music to Mo Better Blues, and we had to do some pre-records for all of the band. To shoot to, and we had taken a break in the studio, and I went over to the piano, and I started playing a piece that I was working on for my own recording situation for Columbia Records. And Spike heard it, and he said, man, I love that. What is that? And I said, it's a tune that I've written for the kids who were massacred in South Africa. It's called Sing Soweto. And he said, well, man, can I use it? And I said, sure. So he asked me to write a orchestral arrangement for it, and once I wrote the arrangement, I brought it to the studio, and I thought that Spike's father was going to conduct it, since he had been conducting all of the other things. And Spike's father looked at me, and I forgot about this, and Spike reminded me of this years later. Spike's father looks at me and he goes, you wrote it, you conduct it. And that was my first time conducting an orchestra in the studio. And once we recorded it, Spike came out and he told me, he says, you have a future in this business. And at the time that he said that, I thought he was just being nice, trying to encourage me. But to my surprise, about a month or two later, he called me to do the music to Jungle Fever. And that's how my film career started.
My guest is trumpeter and composer Terrence Blanchard. His latest CD is called A Tale of God's Will, A Requiem for Katrina. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. ¶¶ My guest is trumpeter and composer Terrence Blanchard. His latest CD is called A Tale of God's Will, A Requiem for Katrina. When you were growing up in New Orleans, you studied with Ellis Marsalis, Wynton and Branford's father. Mm-hmm. Is that how you first heard of Wynton?
Yeah. Well, no, actually, let me back up. Before I started studying with Ellis, I met Wynton Branford when we were in elementary school. We went to Loyola University's summer music program. I think Wynton was going to sixth grade, I was going to fifth grade, and Branford was 2 years older than me. So we were in that summer music program for a couple of weeks, running around Loyola's campus.
When Wynton left Art Blakey's band, I think it was he who suggested that you take his place?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They had open auditions, and I was going to Rutgers University at the time, and he said, "Yo, D, why don't you come up here and audition for the band?" And prior to that, I had met Art through Wynton. Wynton said, you know, told Art, "This is my homeboy from New Orleans. He's a trumpet player as well." It was at a club called Fat Tuesdays where Donald Harrison and myself auditioned for the band and won the audition.
So you dropped out of college to join Art Blakey's band. Did you have any reservations about dropping out?
No, I had no reservations about dropping out of college. Everybody else had reservations about me dropping out of college. My father had a big problem with it. The dean of the music program at the school had a big problem with it because I was not only a jazz major but also a classical major. And he kept telling me, you have the ability to be one of the first guys to have a double major and blah, 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 blah. But I told him, I said, yeah, but the opportunity to play with Art Blakey is a once-in-a-lifetime thing. And I thought that the school would always be there, but not the opportunity to play with Art Blakey. So I jumped at the chance to do that. And, you know, my father had a problem with it for a number of years. But we reconciled our relationship. I remember him telling me that he was proud of me in terms of following my own direction. You know, he was extremely happy that I did what I did in the long run.
What was Blakey's approach to leading the band when you were in it? Like, was he into, like, a lot of rehearsals? Was he into, like, disciplining, like, having a lot of, like, band discipline?
None of the above.
Was he relaxed about that? None of the above.
He was very relaxed. I mean, the thing you have to realize is that his personality was so strong musically. He didn't need to be disciplined. He didn't need to crack the whip. His musical style already did that. You know, we came to that situation with so much respect for him. His main thing was to try to calm us down and to just let us experience being in that band and to make sure that we were working at our craft. He always wanted us to compose music for the band. It was an interesting period because we came to the band constantly wanting to play some of those old arrangements from the bands in the past. And his thing was, no, write your own music. Put your own stamp on this band, put your own stamp on this version of the Jazz Messengers. And that was his way of teaching us. You know, he let us compose the music. You know, I became the musical director of the band. He told me I needed the responsibility of knowing how to lead a band. And he just gave us every opportunity to make as many mistakes as we could. And the thing about it, once we made those mistakes, he was fine. He loved the fact that we would make the mistakes in an attempt to try to do something creative. His thing was, you know, you have to be working at something to move forward in this business.
It sounds like Art Blakey College.
Exactly. The School of Art Blakey is what it was called.
So what's some of the best advice he gave you?
Well, some of the best advice he gave me is a mantra that I preach to my guys. You know, he used to tell us all the time. He says, look, man, you can never become too arrogant in this business. He said, you have to remember, you don't speak above, you don't play your music above anybody's head, or you don't play beneath them. You play right to them, you know. And that means just to be honest and just to be yourself. Trying to do something that you think people want or think, you know, they want you to be is not being true to your soul and to your responsibilities as an artist.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Terrence Blanchard's latest CD is called A Tale of God's Will, A Requiem for Katrina. He'll perform music from it with the New Orleans Philharmonic November 3rd. You can download podcasts of our show by going to our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross. We're closing with music from a 1982 album by Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers, featuring the 19-year-old Terrence Blanchard making his recording debut.
Support for NPR comes from MGM, presenting Lars and the Real Girl, a heartfelt comedy starring Ryan Gosling, now playing in select cities, starts Friday everywhere. From Delacorte Press, publisher of Tales from the Teacher's Lounge and a Reverent View of What It Really Means to Be a Teacher Today by Robert Wilder. And from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/fresh air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Artist Chuck Close is the subject of a new book and of a dance portrait with music by Philip Glass. On the next Fresh Air, we feature an interview with Chuck Close. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.